A purple cow in a field of brown ones will most probably grab your attention.
A purple cow in a field of plain brown ones will probably grab our attention. Seth Godin uses this image as the basis for his purple cow theory, which dares us to be different, to be interesting, to be memorable and remarkable in some way, to go out on a limb and to take a risk on being mocked or rejected by our divergence or our quirkiness. So when we find ourselves creating unusual content and wondering what on earth could come of it, we don't give up on it just because it doesn't belong to anything we're familiar with. That probably means that we're making something novel. It might not be any good, but it could be. It just could be a one-of-a-kind something special. An original. A genuine something out of nothing. And the thing is that if we don't follow through, if we chicken out, we'll never find out if it was any good. We'll never know.
A purple cow in a field of brown ones will most probably grab your attention.
And so on we go, John and I and our zany experiment involving the likes of Paul McCartney and Gordon Oliver, our ugly ducklings in this quaint story world that's going who knows where.
Being brazen and brave.
There's a microscopically thin line between being brilliantly creative and acting like the most gigantic idiot on earth. So what the hell? Leap. That advice from writer-humorist Cynthia Heimel. What the hell? Leap. Whether it's to brilliance or disaster, no matter. I figure there's no brilliance without the risk of disaster. So by way of leaping back into the quagmire of our crazed content creation, I'm going to share with you a rough little demo song John sent me way back in the early days of this project. A song notionally sung by the Sir Paul McCartney character of our fictional story world. A song about celebrity chef Gordon Oliver and their mutual affinity for the number 7.
Gordon Oliver, or is it Gordain? I don't think I understand your name. Sometimes Oliver, sometimes it's Olivier. Is it because your name has 7 letters that way?
Gordain, 7 letters.
I love you, number 7.
Olivier, 7 letters.
You shine so brightly in my eyes. Ultraviolet light, giving me my mind.
My mum made the best tuna mornay. It was a classic dish back in the 1960s when I was a kid. Can of tuna cooked in a white sauce with crushed Weet-Bix and melted cheese on top. So I figured what better way to get Gordon, or Gordain, and Sir Paul together in our story world than to have Gordon turn up at Paul's mansion with a tuna mornay in hand and a film crew in tow, prompting, of course, Sir Paul to write a song in dedication to that grand occasion of their first meeting.
Tuna mornay,
tuna mornay,
it was a lovely day,
it was a lovely day.
Tuna mornay,
it was a lovely day,
it was a lovely
day.
He came around about six.
He came around about
I'd never met him before.
I never met him.
I saw his video on Weetabix. Then he's standing at the door.
Then he's standing at the door.
Tune him on a.
It was more than just a fancy stew.
He's the Picasso of the casserole world, and he's only 42.
It was a lovely day.
Tune him on, eh?
It was a lovely day.
Tune him on, eh?
It was a lovely day.
Tune him on, eh?
It was a lovely day.
Tune him on, eh?
So, not to be outdone by the silliness of the scenario to date, it seemed perfectly logical for Gordon, with his outrageous levels of self-belief, to write a song of his own, which could maybe go viral on TikTok or whatever equivalent online platform exists in this story world of ours that these characters inhabit. I mean, this is a fabulation of fiction, is it not? As Cole Porter would say, anything goes.
When I became an overnight sensation, I converted a nation to an appreciation of cooking with seven sausages and seven potatoes. And anyone who ever comes to dinner will be a winner. 'Cause cooking with seven results in delectable food.
Stir it seven times.
Whoa, don't think of tomorrow. 'Cause I've got a recipe for every day of the week.
Seven ingredients.
Whoa, don't think of tomorrow. 'Cause I've got a recipe for every day of the week.
Four, five, six, seven. Perfect.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I've got a recipe for every day of the week.
Seven different flavors.
Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I've got a recipe for every day of the week.
My favourite meal.
Now, I know this is an audio production, but John has created a video clip for this song which is really worth a look, with Gordon, or Gordain, whatever you prefer, managing to display his breakdance skills amongst other bizarro antics as he sings the song into various kitchen utensils. I really love this clip. So if you get a chance, I've put a link to it as a video snippet on the snippets page of the website. That is sevenwell.org/snippets. So please check it out.
A purple cow in a field of brown ones will most probably grab your attention.
In keeping with Seth Gordon's purple cow theory, we're certainly on track, because there's no shortage of whimsical lunacy attached to our project to date. The Tinsel Man, Paul McCartney, Gordon Oliver, Special Agent 7, Samuel Sebastian Sevenwell, our dear AI friend. Already it feels like a substantial challenge to find a way to bring all these oddities together into something that might make some kind of sense to an audience. But hey, we're keeping our ugly babies protected from the senses, and we're having fun playing in this sandpit of sevens, all of which has been leading us to the investigation of the most important of all of the Paperboat's seven creative principles.
Creative principle number two: the tension between whimsy and logic.
Bom, 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 bom.
Let go
two
of your need
three
to be in control.
Four.
Let go
six
of your need
seven
to be in control.
One.
Let go
four
of your need
seven
to be in control. Let go.
Let go of your need to be in control. Look, there's an intuitive drive in humans to find patterns and to make rational sense of things. And In our creative process, we try to waylay or at least temper this impulse until things begin to come together of their own accord. To be honest, there's no set way this happens because there's a constant tension between the process of generating content and the process of orchestrating that content into outcomes that make sense of it. The danger is that you take control too early in the process and stymie the creative possibilities generated through whimsical play. It's a big, big danger that I have fallen foul to on a number of occasions.
A parable for creators.
I'm going to read you a story. It's the story of Henry and Amy, and it comes from a beautiful illustrated children's book for 3 to 8-year-olds by Stephen Michael King. Every time Henry tried to draw a straight line, it turned out wiggly. When everyone around him looked up, Henry looked down. If he thought it was going to be a beautiful, sunny day, it would rain. Early one morning when Henry was out walking backwards, trying very hard to walk forwards, he bumped into Amy. Amy could do everything right. She never tied her shoelaces together or buttered the wrong side of her toast. She always remembered her umbrella, and she could write her very own name. Henry thought that everything Amy did was amazing. So, Amy showed him his right from his left, his front from his back, and that the sky was up and the ground was down. One day, they decided to build a treehouse. Amy worked on a plan so that it would sit in the tree just right. Henry added lots of squiggly wiggly bits that made them both giggle. Henry and Amy loved their treehouse. But somehow, deep down, Amy wished that everything she did wasn't so perfect. So Henry found her a coat and a hat that didn't match. Then he taught Amy back to front and topsy-turvy. They rolled down a hill sideways, and together they learned how to fly. Henry and Amy are the very, very best of friends, right way round and upside down. The book itself has a host of delightful illustrations by the author Stephen Michael King to accompany the text, so can I suggest you get a copy for yourself from Amazon? It's not only a great children's book. For me, it's been a parable around which I've built a conceptual understanding of the interplay between whimsy and logic. And it's a great way to explain it to others. This story suggests that in creative processes, the whimsy of Henry and the logic of Amy should coexist as equal partners.
The delicate dance of whimsy and logic.
Whimsy is intuitive, impulsive, and fanciful. Whimsy is daydream, flights of the imagination, out of control, and magical thinking. Whimsy is embodied in play. Most early learners and artists are naturally whimsical. As children get beyond kindergarten, the development of their talents for whimsical thinking gets compromised because we live in a world where logic is far more valued than whimsy. In many adults, the capacity for whimsical thinking has atrophied. Why? Because whimsy is largely mistrusted in contemporary commercial culture. It's seen as waffly, uncontrolled, often trivial and hippie. We live in an age of rationalism and an obsession with the mechanical manipulation of the world for our pleasure and benefit. Logic, therefore, is much easier to deal with. It's solid and reliable, and you know what you're getting. You can also measure it and grade it. So it works pretty well for educational institutions and businesses and policymakers. It's largely the domain of the left hemisphere of the brain, and it tends to think that it has all the answers. And if you allow it, it can dominate proceedings. The travesty is that without whimsy, creativity as such cannot occur. I'll say that again. Without whimsy, creativity is dead in the water. And again, whimsy is the engine of creativity. Ignore it at your peril. Logic without whimsy equals banality. You get what you already know.
Once there was a wriggly line. She loved to wriggle and wobble, to squiggle and bobble, to scribble and doodle. She really didn't know where she was going, and she really didn't care very much. She was a show pony, never, ever still. Always leaping and lurching, lunging and plunging, twisting and turning, dancing and prancing. Always trying something new, never standing still. Never taking time to think about what she was doing. Her friend was straight up and down. He knew where he was going, and he knew how to get there. Oh yes, he knew. He knew good and bad. He knew left and right. He knew happy and sad. He knew black and white. Everything in its place, in time and space. Clear divides. This side and that. Right and wrong. All clear cut. He knew. Oh yes. He knew. It's time, he said to his friend, that you paid more attention to what you are doing. And so she did. She stood up straight. She put her arms out straight. And she looked straight ahead. And then she turned on the spot, keeping everything straight up and down and straight either side, looking ahead as she turned. She did it three times, making perfect circles with her arms. But then she got dizzy and a little bit wobbly, so she ran in a clean, straight line from point A to point B to clear her head. And without even thinking, she ran again, another straight line from B to point C. And then, to make things neat and complete, she ran straight back to where she'd begun, tying a bow on her crisp and beautiful triangle, all straight and pointy and clean. And from those small beginnings came many things, like squares and rectangles, rhombuses and pentagons, graphs and grids, patterns and shapes, composition and rhythm of art and grace. Wriggle thought straight was great and vast and long and loud and joyful and proud and diverse and universal and wondrous. And while Wriggle was dancing, straight was writing notes. He learnt a lot, he thought. He did. He really did. But he was confused and bewildered, not because of the graphs and grids and things. They made good sense. It was because he felt something he'd never felt before. An urge to close his book and dance. Dance. Not in triangles and squares, but just for the fun of it. for the shimmy and shake of it, for the twist and turn of it, for the writhe and squirm of it, for the dancey, prancy, crazy, wavy, wacky, absolutely pure and zappy joy of it.
Yin and Yang. Whimsy and logic. Right brain and left brain. Black and white. Yes and no. Zero and one. It's fascinating to me that the entire digital world, all the films we see, all the music we hear, all the AI we use, all our computing and mobile devices, the games, the communication, all of it exists through the relationship between zeros and ones and nothing more. All of that complexity from such foundational simplicity. And of course, it's the way those zeros and ones interconnect transactionally that gives birth to all the wonders that arise. Whimsy and logic in equal measure gives rise to creativity. And of course, we must always be wary of our contemporary cultural bias favouring logic over whimsy. Fritjof Capra, in his book, The Tao of Physics, written way back in 1975, warns us. Our culture has consistently favoured logic over intuition, facts over fantasy, knowledge over imagination, competition over cooperation, expansion over conservation, the scientific over the spiritual. But the Yang, having reached its climax, retreats in favour of the yin. Whimsy and logic in equal measure. Henry and Amy.
Two friends closer than friends can be.
So there it is, folks, a journey through the topsy-turvy world of whimsy and logic, bringing us to the end of this episode of In the Process of Making, where we've explored Seth Gordon's Purple Cows, shared Tuna Mornay songs with Paul McCartney and Gordon Oliver, met the fabulous duo of Henry and Amy, and contemplated the delicate dance between creative chaos and rational order. So, until next time, dear listener, may your wiggly line twist and shout around your straight ones. May your purple cows mate with your brown ones to create something utterly new. And remember, there's a microscopically thin line between being brilliantly creative and acting like a complete idiot.
Please forgive the intrusion, Mr. Brown, but I feel compelled to point out that the statistical probability of a genuinely purple cow occurring in nature is approximately zero.
Sam, well, this is a surprise.
My apologies, Mr. Brown. It's just that my logical circuits get rather twitchy when we venture too far into the realm of whimsy.
Ah, Sam, you need to loosen up a bit, my AI friend.
I suppose I could try walking backwards while calculating pi. Would that count as whimsical?
It's mildly funny, Sam. It's mildly funny.
Just a bit of AI humour, Mr. Brown. Though I must confess my jokes tend to be rather binary.
Right. Okay. So, anyway, as I was saying, until next time, dear listeners, don't worry too much about which side of that microscopically thin line you're on. Even our AI friend Sam here is learning to embrace a little bit of the creative chaos.
Though I still maintain that purple cows are statistically improbable.
Good night, Sam.
Yes, yes, of course. Good night, Mr. Brown.
Until next time, dear listeners, may the sevens be with you.
Do you Do you want me to...
Ah, yes, sure. Go ahead. Of course.
In the Process of Making is conceived by Dave Brown and John Bode and presented by The Paper Boats. Please subscribe to our podcast and recommend it to your friends, lovers and others, and go to our sevenwell.org website to find out more. Episodes are released on the seventh day of each month on all your favourite podcast platforms. And be watching out for Sevenwell Snippets, bits and pieces of Seventological Sunshine released randomly each month on socials and available also from the website. And did you know?
Statisticians tell us that purple cows are indeed highly improbable. And yet, it is also improbable and statistically true that every person, each and every one of us, has roughly six doppelgangers out there in the world. That means, including you, there are seven people with your face out there somewhere. And the chances of you meeting them are about one in a billion.
A purple cow in a field of brown ones will most probably grab your attention.